The broad through line today is the global economy. The subtext might best be characterized as downside risk. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the first day of June. Great, as always, to have you here, everybody. It is rare, oh so rare, that a single news item can take three or four economic threads and wrap them all up in a neat little package. But today is just our lucky day, I guess. We got central banks, electoral politics, business investment, and consumer mindset, the global economy, as well, as I said earlier, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, based in Paris, released its latest economic outlook this morning, and it ain't pretty. Global growth this year is going to be, in 2016, about the same as it was last year, a not impressive 3%, and maybe a small bump next year. That's bad enough. More troubling, though, was the warning that all that slow growth of late has created something called, and this is a quote, a self-fulfilling low-growth trap. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson got explainer duty today.
The trap is this. Companies, they take a look around and see there's not that much demand for their stuff or services. So maybe they hold off on expanding their factory or buying some fancy new software. And those investments, they might cost a bit now, but they could spur innovation or make workers better at their jobs and help the company grow in the future. Here's OECD Secretary General Angel Gurría speaking in Paris.
The result is slow productivity growth, which makes households pessimistic about the pace at which living standards are increasing.
Nervous consumers don't spend as much. Companies see that.
And it results in weak investment. And there we go again.
Wash, rinse, repeat.
Pretty grim.
Ken Kuttner is an econ professor at Williams College. So how do we get off this grim carousel ride?
Oh, well, the OECD wants governments to spend more. Well, the term people used to use would be prime the pump. And the idea is that with government spending boosting the overall level of spending in the economy, then that would improve the climate for investment spending.
Kuttner says the OECD is the latest in a chorus of voices, including the International Monetary Fund, raising the alarm about slow growth. It's calling on policymakers and saying the central banks have used their tools, mainly low interest rates. Now it's your turn. Spend. Vincent Reinhardt is the chief economist at Standish Mellon Asset Management.
Is there a case for fiscal stimulus? Yes. Do we have a political system that would deliver that plan? Not obvious now. When you think about it, we're having a campaign for president, and this isn't part of the conversation.
Reinhardt says candidates promising to increase government spending is a tough sell with voters. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Trump University, as we all know by now, wasn't actually a real university. It was a real estate seminar business, one that ex-staffers in testimony in federal lawsuits say put the hard sell on people who could ill afford to pay tens of thousands of dollars for real estate classes. Fact is, though, that Trump University wasn't an original idea. You turn on your TV or your radio and you'll hear urgent pleas to sign up now and make a fortune all over the place. Happens all the time. Marketplace's Ashley Milne-Tite has more on that.
These seminars dangle the prospect of instant riches. Well, almost. All you have to do is show up, get jazzed up by the speakers.
It's almost like a religious revival.
Harvey Jacobs is a real estate lawyer in Maryland. He's been to dozens of seminars. He says after that initial excitement comes the push to lay some money down, and not just on DVDs or personal coaching sessions.
Believe it or not, I was at one recently that was charging $35,000. For their services.
That was for a weekend where you'd fly to a four-star hotel and meet starry real estate types. Generally, he says you'll pay anywhere from $1,500 to $5,000. Anthony Sanders teaches real estate finance at George Mason University. He says the seminars can be alluring to people who feel financially stuck. They've watched the stock market and the real estate market do well, and they want a piece of the action. But that pot of gold could be elusive. About 10 years ago, he taught one of these seminars, but the company balked when he mentioned risk versus reward.
I was so depressed after I was speaking because I was actually trying to be honest. Now, they didn't want honesty. They said, no, don't tell them about risk. It'll scare them away.
John Glasscock is a professor of real estate at the University of Connecticut School of Business. He says he's worked with professional real estate associations for more than 40 years and met plenty of real estate moguls.
And I can say to you, I've not met one successful investor who told me that he or she got their start from one of these seminars.
He says there are so many cheaper ways to get into real estate. Local associations offer courses where all the costs are up front. You could even begin with no money down at the local library. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, ugly start, slightly less ugly finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The next movie in the Star Wars universe is set to come out at the end of the year. Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, is the official title. But the film is making headlines this week, not because it's going to make big bucks for Disney, which it will. The news in both the New York Post and the Hollywood Reporter is that studio executives didn't much like what they saw in early screenings and have ordered reshoots and have thus fueled speculation that the latest entry in an enormously valuable franchise is in some trouble. Marketplace's Jed Kim looked into those reshoots and what they might mean for a film that is not so far, far away.
If you believe the buzz around Hollywood, Disney execs want a lighter tone for the film. A little less... perhaps a little more... There's a lot at stake for a wildly valuable franchise that's already had its ups and downs. The recent success of Star Wars The Force Awakens makes it important that the brand stays strong. Dana Harris is editor-in-chief of IndieWire, a movie business website.
They've got to keep the tone on point. If they don't get it right, they will have the fury of a thousand suns come down upon them from the fans.
Fans are merciless when it comes to some things.
Excuse me!
Things like universally detested characters.
Misa called Jar Jar Binks!
Having more oversight on a film can reduce the chances of messing up. Again.
While reshoots I don't think are what anybody wants, and you know, I'm sure everybody wants to come out of the screening room saying, oh my gosh, this is fantastic, I don't think it's the end of the world either.
Once, reshoots were considered really bad news. Today...
there has been a shift in the industry regarding reshoots, which is why it has also been renamed as additional photography.
Jason Squire is a professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. He says reshoots are valuable because they allow for changes. Squire says it's a lesson Disney learned from another of its assets, Marvel.
Additional photography is baked into the Marvel system when producing a movie.
For big blockbusters, reshoots are now written into the budget. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Tracy was talking about the global economy up at the top of the program, how the OECD says it's not all it could be. Here's a little bit more on America in that global economy. Canada is our single largest trading partner, single in this case being defined as a single country. The European Union, though, is far and away the biggest single entity with which we trade. And that's why what's going on in the UK matters. 3 weeks from tomorrow, British voters are going to decide in or out, stay in the European Union or leave. Brexit, as it's come to be known. British exit. Get it? The Brits are going to vote the way they want to vote, but if it is for a Brexit, there's going to be some collateral damage. The tens of thousands of American expats who live and work in the UK. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that.
The Odeon Cinema in Leicester Square, a world-famous venue for movie premieres. Last week, it unveiled a rather unusual production.
We had a premiere, a gala black tie red carpet premiere that rivaled the premieres of any Hollywood blockbuster, and yet this was a documentary film about Brexit.
That's Hunter Dubose, a London-based, American-born investment banker. He co-produced and partly financed Brexit, the movie.
We, the people, are being cajoled, frightened, and bullied into surrendering our democracy and freedom. This film is a rallying cry.
The movie urges the Brits to vote to pull out of the EU in next month's referendum.
I feel that this country is my adoptive home as well. And for me, I feel passionately about Britain leaving the European Union.
Hunter Dubose believes that leaving the EU will set Britain and its businesses free.
Right now, we are strangled by regulations, laws, and policies originating from mainstream Europe.
You think your business will do much better if this country is outside the EU?
Without question.
Other American expats living here are far happier about the European Union. Shara Terry Young is an accountant from Baltimore. She wants the EU to go much further down the road towards political union and turn itself into a federation.
Because the United States is such a is all about federalism, and federalism makes sense to me as an American. You're stronger when you work together.
She's living and working in London because her husband is European and has the right to settle in any of the 28 member states. Now, she says, the British referendum campaign is turning her off the UK.
You see more and more headlines about immigrants are buying all the houses, they're taking all of the jobs, they're stealing all the benefits. It's not very welcoming, and it doesn't really make us want to stay in the long term.
There is a tide of anti-EU propaganda like this Brexit song. Another American expat who finds this a little worrying is Christian Del Valle. He arrived here 17 years ago from Texas. He now runs an ecological investment fund and advisory business.
A large number of our staff are EU nationals. I would be concerned, certainly, if retaining the expertise that I currently have on the team became more difficult due to a Brexit.
A British government, even after a Brexit, would hardly try to expel the 3 million EU nationals currently working in the UK. The economy would collapse. But Del Valle is worried that the barriers would go up and he'd be cut off from his many European investors and clients.
Would you consider relocating if there were a Brexit?
There could be a very elevated chance that we would take the decision that our business was best based elsewhere.
In continental Europe?
Yes.
Political and business leaders in Britain and around the world have lined up to warn that Brexit will have dire consequences for the UK. The Bank of England, the IMF, the OECD, even President Obama have all weighed in. But John Scott, an American expat living here in Wimbledon, is not impressed with the warnings of almost biblical disaster.
We're going to have wars, we're going to have pestilence, we're going to have
a plague of locusts
and all the other plagues that befell Egypt are going to befall England. That's absolute rubbish. Are they joking? Come on.
Scott is fiercely pro-Brexit and furious at any suggestion that Britain could not prosper outside the EU as a fully independent, self-governing nation.
It just really galls me no end. So while I'm American, I still think that what's good for Britain is to bloody damn get out and keep your sovereignty.
But it must be said, all foreign interventions in this British decision seem to backfire. When President Obama uttered his warning against Brexit a month ago, support for the Leave campaign picked up. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The campaign contributions buy you a seat at the table, but you have to know what fork to use.
Money, power, influence, and hedge funds. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is basically flat today, 17,789. The NASDAQ up 4 points, less than a 10%, 4,952. The S&P 500 up about 2 points, also about a 10%, 2,099. American automakers skidded today. General Motors off 3.33% on disappointing sales for last month. Ford sputtered 2.8% today. It, too, reported lower sales in May. Under Armour clanked down 3.9%. I love that clank down. The sportswear firm cut its full-year revenue guidance. It said the closure of the sporting goods chain Sports Authority is going to hurt its sales. On a positive retail note, handbag maker Michael Kors swung up 6.6% today. I think they make more than handbags, though, right? Bond prices fell just a tad. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of weeks ago, we had our China correspondent, Rob Schmitz, on the program. I mean, we always have him on the program, right? Because he's our China correspondent. But Rob was on a book tour for a book that he wrote as a follow-up to a radio series he did, both of which are called The Street of Eternal Happiness, about the people who live and work on the same street that Rob lives on in Shanghai. I promised at the time we would have updates on some of the characters Rob introduced us to in that series, and so today, a woman who left her coal mining town to run a thriving flower shop on The Street of Eternal Happiness. Here's Rob.
At Zhao Shuling's tiny flower shop on the Street of Eternal Happiness, there's an unhappy customer. Why aren't there price tags on any of the flowers, he complains. Zhao calms him with a smile, bargains a little, and makes another sale. She's used to dealing with angry men.
My father had five daughters, and he hated us. Girls never had status in our family. When guests came for meals, we weren't allowed to eat at the table. I'm used to it.
Zhao grew up in the countryside near the birthplace of Confucius in Shandong province. The great sage's philosophy of social order came to define ancient Chinese society, rules of behavior still embedded in Chinese culture today. At their core is the belief in a rigid social hierarchy where women are relegated to serve men. Among their most important roles, obedience and giving birth to a son. Zhao gave birth to two sons, but obedience didn't come naturally to her.
My father once told me Confucius didn't like women, so I asked him, then why did he marry a woman? He didn't think that was funny.
When Zhao was a girl, she suffered from leukemia. Her parents reacted by purchasing a coffin. She survived. Her parents sold the coffin, but everyone in her village knew about her illness, and her parents had a difficult time finding a husband. They settled on a coal miner from the nearby mountains.
After we married, whenever I did something wrong, he beat me and he'd break things. After I had my sons, I left for Shanghai. My sisters still praise me for that. They say every woman in our hometown is unhappy, but I was brave enough to escape.
It was the early 1990s and hundreds of millions of migrants, many of them women, were inspired by a month-long train ride that leader Deng Xiaoping took through southern China. The elderly leader told his countrymen to go out to the factory towns of China to make money. He repeated the phrase, Gai Ge Kai Feng, reform China's economy and open itself up to the outside world. Zhao moved to China's most cosmopolitan city to work in a factory, earning enough to start her own flower shop. She brought her sons to Shanghai, saving enough to buy both of them apartments in a city of millions near her hometown.
When my boys were young, they thought I was a bad mother because I left home. But I began sending them money from Shanghai, and they slowly changed their minds. Now my eldest son tells me, Mom, Dad doesn't deserve you.
Last year, Zhao's husband was laid off at the coal mine, joining millions of men who have lost their jobs due to China's slowdown, and he showed up on her doorstep. Zhao didn't allow him to live with her. She helped him find a job at a hot pot restaurant where he bunks in a dorm with workers half his age, earning a fraction of what she earns.
He doesn't dare beat me now. I've earned my independence. I support our sons with my savings. He can't even support his own family anymore.
Zhao says he's not much use around the flower shop either.
The customers leave once they see him. He doesn't know how to wrap flowers, arrange them, nothing. He can't even handle phone orders when I'm away. He tells customers to call my cell. He's worthless.
Zhao is working up the courage to file for divorce, but she's scared of how her family back home will react. Divorce is still rare in her hometown. But that's not all she's afraid of.
He's told me, if I can't have you alive, I'll have you dead. This comment just shows how stupid and backwards the thinking is in my hometown. I'm scared he'll try and kill me. In my hometown, men have beaten their wives to death for things like this.
In his song, Dad, I'm Back, rapper Jay Cho sings, I hear peace comes after war, but why does my dad continue to beat my mom? The song about domestic abuse is popular in China, where more and more young Chinese are demanding change. 5 months ago, the change began. For the first time in modern history, China made domestic abuse a crime. But on the Street of Eternal Happiness, Zhao Shuling is too scared to divorce.
I'm afraid I'll die with everlasting regret that I'd never truly loved anyone. This marriage has caused me so much pain.
If I only had two pair of wings, sings Jay Cho in his famous song, I would quietly take my mother away from here. Zhao Shuling uses the Chinese phrase si bu ming mu when she talks about staying married to her husband. It means her eyes will remain open when she dies, a symbol of regret in Chinese culture. But lately, when I visited her, Zhao seemed stronger. and she seems closer to making that difficult decision. Her biggest hope, she tells me, is to die with her eyes closed. On the Street of Eternal Happiness in Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
Rob's whole series from a couple of years ago is worth listening to. It's at marketplace.org, where conveniently there is a link that you can click to buy the book, too. One can essentially guarantee that we have not yet reached peak money in politics for this election cycle, both in terms of absolute dollar amounts solicited and raised and stories about that money and whence it comes. Our entry today is hedge funds. Political contributions from them are at an all-time high and growing, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
It's hard enough to snag an interview with a big hedge fund manager, but when you're asking about campaign contributions, crickets. Yep, nothing. But then I finally found someone.
Hi, Ted. I'm great. How are you?
Good to see you.
Ted is Ted Peters, chairman of the Bluestone Financial Institutions Group. Peters and a partner run a couple of different funds from their office in Wayne, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. One of the funds is a hedge fund.
$90 million of total assets under management.
Peters is not a huge player in the hedge fund world, but he does make campaign contributions.
I basically support people who I think are moderate and are practical. For president, I supported John Kasich and went to his fundraisers, wrote some checks for that.
Peters points to a picture of himself at another fundraiser with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Peters didn't follow Christie into the Donald Trump camp, though.
Trump is just too extreme for me.
Peters describes himself as an Eisenhower Republican, a moderate who's given to candidates from both parties. Now he'll focus his contributions farther down the ballot, giving to candidates for Congress who will still reach across the aisle. Why give?
The levels which I give at certainly are not going to have any influence. Do you buy some kind of access? You may. You certainly may, yeah.
Peters figures he's given $10,000 or less a year for the past 15 to 20 years. He says the members of Congress he's given to would take his calls and meet with him, though Peters doesn't like to leave his office in Wayne, a quaint town he proudly shows off as he opens the door to see me out.
So over across the street, that red brick building, we started that, was called National Bank of the Main Line.
A world away from Wayne, the big hedge fund managers are contributing millions to politicians. In fact,
hedge fund donations already exceed $80 million.
That's Sheila Krumholtz, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonprofit that tracks political spending. She says hedge funds have already spent 50% more than they did at this point in the last presidential election. Krumholtz says their political contributions really took off in 2008, going from a few million dollars to almost $21 million.
They want a relationship with power brokers in Washington who can help grease the skids on their agenda.
And it's a big agenda. Hedge funds want to stave off more government regulation. They want bankruptcy laws that ensure they're first in line to get their money back if one of their investments goes sour. And they want to be sure no one jacks up the tax rate they pay on their cut of the profits they make for investors. But hedge funds aren't just making political contributions.
The campaign contributions buy you a seat at the table, but you have to know what fork to use.
That's where the lobbyists come in. And hedge funds are also spending more on lobbying, says Jack Pitney, a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College.
Campaign contributions get you access to members of Congress, but then you send in the people who really know the issues and try to get an outcome that's most favorable to the industry that's being regulated.
But spending only has to be reported by registered lobbyists. And lots of people lobby, but don't have to register. So we don't know exactly how much hedge funds are spending on lobbyists. Ditto for campaign contributions. Because of dark money, contributions to groups that never have to say where their money comes from, which is just fine with secretive hedge funds. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, insult added to injury division. We've done some coverage of the now troubled but once golden biotech startup Theranos, the company whose cutting-edge blood test kits turned out not to have been so cutting-edge after all. Last year, CEO and founder Elizabeth Holmes was at the top of the Forbes magazine list of this country's richest self-made women, with an estimated net worth, based on her slice of the company, of $4.5 billion. This morning, Forbes, with an eye toward Theranos' difficulties, shall we say, took Holmes off the list and rated her net worth, and this is their word, not ours, at nothing. All right, here's the way it shook out on Wall Street today. The Dow basically flat. The NASDAQ up 4 points, less than a 10%. The S&P 500 up 2 points, about a 10% there as well. I probably should have just said flat all the way around, right? Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.